At this time, we would like to start the keynote lecture. We will play the pre-recorded lecture, but Dr. Sandman, the keynote lecturer, will join us in a live Q&A after the lecture from New York. So without further ado, we will start the keynote lecture.
Hello. My name is Tomoaki Tamaki and the chair of the first session. It is my honor to introduce Dr. Peter Sandman, the keynote lecturer of this symposium. Dr. Sandman is a world-renowned risk communication specialist and the creator of the famous formula of risk equals hazard plus outrage. Dr. Sandman was a professor at Rutgers University from 1977 to 1995. And was a founder and the director of its environmental communication research program. In 1995, Dr. Sandman left the university and became a full-time consultant. The list of his clients is extensive and impressive. To name a few, Intel, Novartis, DuPont, Imperial Oil, Shell, and many governmental and international agencies such as US Nuclear Regulatory Commission and WHO. According to his biography, he has worked with environmental activists also. I truly believe that Dr. Sandman is the best source of information and wisdom for risk communication. Dr. Sandman has a great website, psandman.com, and I urge anyone with interest in risk communication to visit his website. I could describe my admiration for Dr. Sandman more, but unfortunately, the time is limited. So without further ado, it is my honor to introduce to you our keynote lecturer of this symposium, Dr. Peter Sandman.
Thank you, Tomo, and thank you for inviting me to speak. Just a couple of introductory remarks for the record, as the title slide suggests. We are recording this on December 16. It's going to be played at the start of the symposium on February 7th. With luck, I will then call in for a Q&A that will be live after the recorded presentation. The presentation at the request of the university is mostly generic. It is not a presentation on how to do risk communication in a radiation disaster. It's not a presentation on how to do risk communication about radiation. It's a presentation on how to do risk communication. And that's why in the title, radiation is in parentheses. Although I will make reference from time to time to the particularities of radiation, my main goal in this 50 minutes is to lay out some of the basics of risk communication. And I should also say the basics of risk communication in the way I see it, my approach to risk communication. As is pretty obvious, if you had a different speaker, you would hear somewhat different basics. So with that introduction, let's have the next slide, please. And I want to start with the traditional definition of risk, the definition of risk that engineers use, that risk assessors use, that's many generations old. And it's very simple. It's a multiplication of two variables, magnitude, how bad is it if it happens, times probability, how likely is it to happen. You get your best measure of how bad it is, your best measure of how likely it is. You multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. Next slide, please. Back in the 1980s, it became clear to me that that definition of risk, that traditional definition of risk, is not at all what normal people mean by risk. When people in the normal course of their lives talk about risk, they don't mean magnitude times probability. So I started trying to develop a new definition of risk. And I wound up coining the formula that I'm famous for and that Tomo mentioned in his introduction and that is in the title of this presentation and that I'm about to explain to you. Next slide, please. So I started with the idea that, all right, let's take what technical people mean by risk, magnitude times probability, and let's give it a new label. So I said, let's call that hazard. Technical people have a different definition for hazard, but I said, no, let's redefine what they mean by risk and call that hazard. Next slide. And then I said, let's take what normal people, what ordinary people mean by risk, and let's call that outrage. And I need to pause to acknowledge that outrage is a difficult word, even in English. Even to people who are native speakers of English, when I developed this formula in the 1980s, I was working mostly with environmental controversies, and the word outrage very nicely captured the kind of self-righteous anger of the neighbors of a polluting factory, say. So it seemed like the right word at the time. But as I broadened my work and I started working in all kinds of risk settings, it became pretty clear that the word outrage was not ideal, but I'm stuck with it. It's my jargon. I'm famous for it. And I'm not about to change it. But I do want to apologize for it. But what I mean by outrage is certainly fear. It is also anger. It is sometimes misery. And it is sometimes concern, which is kind of the wimpy cousin of fear. It's small fear. All of that is what I mean by outrage. All the various ways in which people can be emotionally aroused by a risk. And which one applies, which kind of outrage applies, really does vary with the situation. So, in a nuclear crisis, it's going to be fear. In a policy fight, it might very well be anger. I think in this pandemic, for people who are going into, year after year of enduring the pandemic, a very big piece of our outrage is misery. So it's different emotions depending on different situations. And the word I often use is to try to capture it again in English is upset. If you are upset, if you're emotionally aroused in any way, that's what I mean by outrage. Next slide, please. So I coined the formula, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. And having apologized for the word outrage, I now need to apologize for the plus sign. I didn't mean that literally. I wasn't proposing arithmetic. But since my audience was very largely engineers, I became accustomed when I was presenting this concept to listening to people mutter to themselves in the back of the room, that's what happens when you let a humanities major write a formula. They hated that plus sign. So I came up with a version that engineers like better. Next slide, please. I said, all right, risk is a function of hazard and outrage. And that makes my technical audience much happier. It means the same thing to me, but it makes them much happier. And I need to sit on this slide for a couple of minutes and explain what I mean here. The core problem in risk communication is the very low correlation between whether something is dangerous and whether it's upsetting. That is, in my jargon, the low correlation between hazard and outrage. That correlation in various studies is around 0.2. And if you remember some statistics, you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. You square 0.2, you get 0.04, essentially no variance at all. You know, so that's the core problem. If you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. Okay. On the other hand, there is quite a high correlation between outrage and perceived hazard. Okay. So that where outrage and hazard are essentially unrelated, outrage and hazard perception are very closely related. That correlation is about 0.7, accounting for roughly half the variance. A very significant relationship between outrage and hazard perception. By the way, just to complete this troika, the correlation between hazard and hazard perception is also low. People perceive hazard in a way that's unrelated to the actual hazard. Their outrage is also unrelated to the actual hazard, but the outrage is very strongly related to their perception of the hazard. Well, whenever you have a strong correlation, the question you ask if you're any kind of scientist at all is, what's the causal structure of that strong correlation? How are they causally related? And that's an important question in risk communication. And to simplify it a little bit, the question we're asking is, are people upset because they think something is dangerous? Or do people think something is dangerous because they're upset? Now, that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, the solution is to try to teach them that it's not dangerous if it's not. If, on the other hand, they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them, to figure out what's making them upset, and find a way to reduce their outrage. So that's a very important question, and it's been studied a lot. There are arrows in both directions. But the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong. And the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is very weak. So for the most part, it's not true that people are upset because they think something is dangerous. It's much more true that people think something is dangerous because they're upset. The same is true on the other end of the relationship. People aren't calm because they think it's safe. They think it's safe because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. And hazard isn't the engine of anything. Off in a corner, we have hazard. It's important. I'm not suggesting it doesn't matter, whether you kill people. Of course it matters whether you kill people, but it doesn't have very much effect on hazard perception. It doesn't have very much effect on outrage. It's important for its own sake, but hazard perception and outrage are closely tied. And in that connection, hazard perception is mostly effect and outrage is mostly cause. Okay, that's absolutely central to what I'm trying to get at, and what I hope it suggests to you is that trying to calm people down by educating them is getting the causality right. I'm sorry, it's getting the causality wrong. Trying to calm people by educating them is thinking, if I can only explain the hazard better, I will reduce the outrage. Similarly, trying to get people upset by educating them about how dangerous something is also is getting the causality wrong. The outrage is mostly the cause. The hazard perception is mostly the effect. If you want to manage hazard perception, you have to manage outrage. And with that basis, the next thing that I want to do, and the most important thing I want to do, is graph hazard against outrage. Next slide, please. So here we have a blank graph. We're going to graph hazard against outrage. And again, I want to remind you, the correlation between hazard and outrage is 0.2. which is to say, if this were a scatter plot and we were going to put dots in all over this graph for various situations, there would be dots everywhere. There's essentially no correlation. There would be dots in all four corners of the map. I'm not going to give you dots, but what I am going to do is give you circles. Next slide, please. And we're going to start in the lower right-hand corner of this map. High hazard, low outrage. These are situations that endanger you, but don't upset you. It might be smoking, if you're a smoker. It might be eating too much. These are risks that routinely cause harm, but don't routinely cause outrage. And this is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. It is the most traditional kind of risk communication. It goes back thousands of years. You know, warning people is the first kind of risk communication in history. It's also the first kind of risk communication in our own lives. Our parents are busy warning us long before it occurs to them to reassure us. So it's the very most fundamental kind of risk communication. Essentially, the essence of precaution advocacy is watch out. You're trying to tell people to watch out. Next slide, please. And in ways I hope are obvious, this arrow is the core of risk of precaution advocacy. If you understand what I was saying about the causal relationship among these variables, the essence of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to get people to be more willing to take precautions or demand precautions or tolerate precautions. So this arrow is the very essence of precaution advocacy. This is what activists do. They try to get people more upset so that they will demand more precautions. This is also what safety people do on the scene, you know, in with employees. If you're working in a nuclear facility of any kind and you're trying to get employees to take the risk seriously, if you don't understand, you might think you can educate them to take the risk seriously. But if you understand the causal structure, you know that that's, you know, it's not completely useless, but it's much weaker as a strategy because it's got the causality backwards, and you're much better off if you want your employees to take precautions more seriously. You're much better off getting them more outraged, more worried, more frightened, more something with some emotional heft to it, so that the outrage will motivate the precaution taking. So, I mean, there are lots of things you can do in precaution advocacy, and I'm not going to have time to do more than just sketch in a few of them. Arousing fear or anger or other kinds of outrage, obviously, appeals to existing outrage. You might not have to arouse it. It might be there already, and you have to connect your issue to something that already outrages them. You know, this is typical of what that stupid company does, so you take existing outrage at the company and apply it to the thing you want people to be angry at the company or for doing. That would be, you know, mobilizing existing outrage. Sometimes you appeal to needs rather than to outrage itself, and that can work. But your goal in all of this is to generate more hazard perception by arousing outrage or something akin to outrage. And I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, one of the characteristics of the lower right-hand corner of this map that is of low outrage, high hazard situations is people are too apathetic. A synonym for low outrage is apathy. Okay. And apathetic people are not an easy audience to deal with. Apathetic people are, have a short attention span. And that means precaution advocacy. You have to keep your message short. You have to repeat your message a lot because they're not really listening. You have to keep it simple. You have to try to make it interesting. If you can make your message a little bit more interesting, maybe you can get more attention and you can run longer and say more and teach them more. So making it interesting is important. These are basics of precaution advocacy. And I think that's probably all I have time to say about precaution advocacy now. Next slide, please. But I did want to give you some examples of areas where radiation precaution advocacy is likely to be called for. Getting employees of nuclear facilities or radioactive cleanups to keep taking precautions seriously, to wear their safety gear, pay attention to cumulative exposure measures, and so forth. Getting employees of medical and dental facilities to use the equipment, if they're using equipment that involves ionizing radiation, to take those precautions seriously. Persuading uninterested neighbors of nuclear facilities to read and learn the instructions about evacuation or about shelter in place. What are the procedures? What do the warnings look like? What evacuation routes do you want them to know? Warning people about worst case scenarios, that worst case scenarios are horrific. And as you'll see, worst case scenarios show up in outrage management, which I'm going to get to in a minute as well. These are all things where radiation precaution advocacy is likely to be needed. And you will notice that they're largely about employees. In general, familiarity breeds contempt. People who are highly familiar with a risk stop taking that risk seriously enough. And precaution advocacy is almost always needed in a employment context. Even if you work in an area where everybody else in the known universe is afraid, as is the case for ionizing radiation, I mean, pretty much count on most people finding ionizing radiation frightening. You can count on people who work with it all the time finding it not sufficiently frightening. And I have done work since the sponsor for this event is a medical school. I have done work with medical schools where the laboratory scientists in medical schools are famous for ignoring safety precautions, and putting their lunch in the same refrigerator as dangerous materials, and doing a variety of other things that you do when you have become immune to outrage and you start being careless. So I think that's all I want to say about precaution advocacy. Next slide, please. So let's go to the opposite corner here. Risks that are high in outrage and low in hazard. And this is the venue of what I call outrage management. In precaution advocacy, people are endangered but not upset. In outrage management, people are upset but not endangered. Next slide, please. So the arrow goes in the other direction. In precaution advocacy, we're trying to get them more upset so that they will take or demand precautions, the intermediate variable being hazard perception. Increased outrage leading to increased hazard perception, leading to increased willingness to take or demand or tolerate precautions. That's precaution advocacy. In outrage management, it's exactly the same causal structure. You're just on the other side of it. Now you're trying to get people to have decreased outrage so that they will have decreased hazard perception, so that they will have decreased inclination to take or demand or tolerate precautions. I want to point out just very quickly that it's entirely possible that you are doing outrage management while somebody else is doing precaution advocacy on exactly the same hazard and exactly the same audience, or vice versa. You know, somebody thinks people are too apathetic. Somebody else thinks people are too upset. Same people, different opinion. You know, so the activists are busy saying this could kill you. For God's sake, take it seriously. And the company is saying, no big deal. Don't worry about it. Stop fretting. You know, stop being so upset. It's also true that the same source might be doing precaution advocacy with one audience and outrage management with a different audience on the same hazard. So you could be simultaneously trying to persuade your neighbors to calm down and your employees to wear their safety gear. You got one audience that's not upset enough and another audience that's too upset. I think those are things worth bearing in mind. In precaution advocacy, there is a process when people are apathetic, they have a short attention span. When people are outraged, they have quite a long attention span, but they don't want to pay attention to you. They're interested in the topic. They'll come to a meeting and stay till midnight. There's no problem getting their attention. The problem is they don't believe a word you say. They're absolutely convinced that this is dangerous. And if you try to tell them it's not dangerous, they are very likely to resist the message. The extreme case of this, which, you know, I experienced again and again and again, and I think anybody who works with radiation controversies experiences this. Imagine a room full of highly outraged people. And there you are in the front of the room telling them that this situation is not dangerous. They're worried about the casks of low-level radioactive waste that you have in your backyard, and your backyard is very close to their backyard, and they're worried about those low-level radioactive wastes. And you're out there saying, you know, we have very good science to tell you that this is not dangerous. And someone stands up in the back of the room and says, you're lying. We're all going to die of leukemia. And there's tumultuous applause. And you ask yourself, what does it take to applaud the idea that you're going to die of leukemia? Okay. And the answer is outrage. When people are outraged enough, they would rather believe they're going to die of leukemia than believe you're not the evil source of horrible risk that they think you are. They will applaud bad news. They will get very angry at good news. They don't want to believe it's safe. They are more committed to their outrage than they are to their safety. If you've never had an audience like that and you've never been an audience like that, you must be a very weird person because that's part of human nature. That's not an American trait. That's a universal human trait. When we are upset enough, we become deeply committed to remaining upset and very resistant to being reassured. So that has implications. It suggests that if you want to calm people down, you need to do more listening than talking. You listen while they vent. If you do that long enough, eventually they want to hear your response. And when you finally get to respond, you start by echoing. You show that you have heard some of what they've complained about. After you've echoed for a while, you find something to agree with. You don't start out by telling them they're wrong. You start out by agreeing with some of what they told you. And then little by little, eventually, as you earn a little bit of trust and earn a little bit of attention, you know, you may earn the right to say, there are a few things you said that I think are not consistent with the science. Is it all right if I try to explain to you where I think the science points in a different direction than your concerns have pointed? So, I mean, you do eventually want to get around telling them they're wrong. Because you think they're wrong, but that's not where you start. That's much later in the process of dealing with outraged people. And then, you know, there's a long list of things you do in order to diminish outrage. And again, I don't have time to go through all of them. Certainly not time to go through them in any detail. But I'll sort of mention some of them. You stake out the middle rather than the extreme. If they're saying this is incredibly dangerous and you're saying it's perfectly safe, you will lose. But if they're saying it's incredibly dangerous and you're saying it's moderately dangerous, you might win. You might be able to convince them to move toward the middle if you don't take the other extreme. Acknowledging prior misbehaviors, if there are things you have done wrong or things that have gone wrong vis-a-vis your facility or with, you know, with respect to your facility, you know, be sure to acknowledge those prior mistakes and misbehaviors. Acknowledge your current problems. Give them credit for things you have done that they demanded that you do. One of the things I encountered endlessly with my clients in outrage management is, you know, angry neighbors would demand, angry and frightened neighbors would demand that the facility take some precaution. And the facility didn't want to take the precaution because they thought it was unnecessary, but the neighbors were upset, and upset neighbors can affect your bottom line. They can affect your ability to keep operating. So eventually the company decided to go ahead and take the precaution. Okay, so far so good. This is a victory for the angry neighborhood or the frightened neighborhood. And what typically the company wanted to do is to say, you know, this had nothing to do with you people. We're not doing this because you asked us to. We're doing it because we're very gracious. We're doing it in an abundance of caution. We're doing it because we're such a careful company. So the outraged people had a real victory, and the company snatched it away from them by pretending that they were doing voluntarily what they were actually doing under pressure. So if you're giving in to pressure, for heaven's sake, you know, get the value, the outrage reduction value out of it by saying so. So acknowledging the ways in which you know, giving them credit for the things they have made you do is a piece of outrage management. Sharing control, setting up advisory committees, for example, is a way of sharing control. Setting up accountability mechanisms. So, you know, if something goes wrong, they know that you won't be able to hide it. You've got an accountability mechanism. There's a television camera pointing on the key gauges in your control room. And if those gauges start going, you know, crazy, they can just go to that channel on their cable system and watch your gauge go crazy, and they know that you can't hide it. And that reduces outrage. Of course, it increases outrage if your gauge goes crazy, but that's a different story. But knowing that they can hold you accountable helps reduce outrage. So these are all things that go into outrage management. The generic point here that I want to emphasize, this is a completely different toolkit from precaution advocacy. They have nothing in common. Okay, next slide, please. Some quick examples where outrage management is needed. You'll notice this is a longer list. Almost any interaction with anti-nuclear activists, addressing the implications of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for talking about non-weapons nuclear applications, talking about problems and mistakes that didn't do serious harm, reassuring anxious neighbors, reassuring people that the worst case scenarios are unlikely. You remember I said under precaution advocacy, telling them how horrific the worst case scenario is something you do in precaution advocacy. Telling them how unlikely it is something you do in outrage management. Reassuring anxious patients that a medical procedure that uses ionizing radiation is a small risk. Talking to excessively frightened people, even in a crisis, and so on and so on. There's quite a long list of times when outrage management is called for with regard to radiation. Next slide, please. Very quickly, I just want to put a little bit of meat on the bones of what outrage is. This is a list of components of outrage, and you know, I'm labeling the two columns safe and risky rather than low outrage and high outrage, because what I'm trying to convince you is low outrage is one way of being safe, and high outrage is one way of being risky. Low hazard is a different way of being safe. High hazard is a different way of being risky. So if a risk is voluntary and natural and familiar and not memorable and so on down the left-hand side, people are going to be calm even if it's deadly. And if a risk is coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, and so on down the right-hand side, people are going to be frightened and upset even if it's not very dangerous. So I don't have time to do an outrage assessment of radiation or of various radiation situations. But if you imagine, you know, yourself or not you, because you guys are familiar with radiation, imagine me, imagine my employer has assigned me to, you know, to move. I have to move in order to keep my job, and now I'm next door to one of Japan's functioning nuclear power plants. And this is my first exposure to nuclear power. So how much outrage am I likely to experience? Let's go down the list. My exposure is coerced. I didn't want to move here. It's certainly not natural. It's even worse than industrial, right? I mean, you guys create elements God never thought of. It's as unnatural as it can be. It's totally unfamiliar. It's a very exotic risk. It's really memorable. You know, I mean, I remember Three Mile Island. You, of course, all remember Fukushima. We all together remember Chernobyl. Serious nuclear accidents are memorable. It's a very dreaded way to die. I would rather, you know, be in a car accident than die of radiation poisoning. Obviously, radiation disasters are catastrophic rather than chronic. Next slide, please. We're going to go on with this list. Unknowable, that is lots of expert disagreement, lots of uncertainty about the size of the risk. It's certainly controlled by others. I have no control over whether you're going to radiate me. It's profoundly unfair. I don't get any of the benefits. I only get the risk. I get no benefit from your facility. I'll give you credit for moral relevance. I can't think of a way in which a nuclear power plant is immoral. So I think I'll give you that one. The companies, both in Japan and in the United States, both companies and government have been profoundly untrustworthy with regard to nuclear facilities. And the process has been profoundly unresponsive. You don't want to listen. You don't want to take people's concerns seriously. There's a long history of unresponsiveness. All right, that's 11 out of 12 on the risky side of the outrage due diligence. So you're looking at a situation which is quite likely to provoke outrage. And that's as much as I want to say about that. Enough of outrage management. Let's go on to the next slide. Now we're in the upper right-hand corner. High hazard, high outrage. This is the third paradigm, which of course is crisis communication. In precaution advocacy, the paradigm is watch out. In outrage management, and I don't think I got around to saying this, in outrage management, the paradigm is calm down. The message isn't calm down, because calm down isn't the calming message, particularly if your tone of voice and your demeanor suggests what you're saying is calm down, you idiot, calm down, you hysterical fool. People don't respond well to being told that they're idiots and hysterical. So calm down is almost never the message, but it is the paradigm. It is the goal to calm them down. In crisis communication, the paradigm is we'll get through this together. Next slide, please. No slot, no arrow. no arrow. In precaution advocacy, you're trying to manage the outrage up. In outrage management, you're trying to manage the outrage down. In crisis communication, the outrage is already high, and it's supposed to be high. It belongs high because the hazard is high. The goal in risk communication should be to get the outrage equal to the hazard. If you imagine, you know, a diagonal line that starts at the origin and goes up to the upper right-hand corner of the map, the goal is to be on that line. In outrage management, the outrage is too high. In precaution advocacy, the outrage is too low. That's why there are arrows. In crisis communication, the outrage is as it should be. Okay, and you know, the cardinal sin of crisis communication is to try to calm people down. People are rightly upset. Their being upset is useful. It will motivate them to take precautions. You don't want them calm, or you shouldn't want them calm. In outrage management, you want them calm. In crisis communication, you want them to continue to be upset, but you want them to be able to bear it. Okay, so even though there's no arrow, there's plenty of communication to be done. In crisis communication, you want to validate their outrage, your right to be upset, your right to be frightened. This is a horrible situation. And then you want to help them bear it. You want to help them bear their outrage, and you want to help them bear the high hazard. Okay, and then, and this is the payoff, you want to help them make wise rather than unwise decisions about what precautions make sense. You know, in crisis situations, people are rightly upset. That doesn't mean they'll do the right thing. You know, they might be rightly upset and do the wrong thing. And your goal is to guide them through the crisis. You can't guide them through the crisis if you're trying to tell them it's not a crisis. You can't guide them through the crisis if your message is stop thinking this is a crisis and leave me alone. You know, so the core of crisis communication is the absence of the arrow, that you're not trying to reduce the outrage. You take the high outrage as appropriate, and you try to help people bear it and make wise decisions in the face of their temptation to make unwise decisions. So we'll get through this together is the paradigm. And this is a third toolkit. Some of the strategies here, don't over reassure, you know, which is what the one I've been emphasizing. Don't tell them it's not serious when it is serious. Acknowledge uncertainty. Crises have a high degree of uncertainty, and acknowledging uncertainty is important. Be willing to speculate. You know, speculation has had a bad press, but you can't communicate in a crisis without talking about what's probably going to happen next. And that's speculation. But you want to speculate in a way that doesn't over reassure, and you want to speculate in a way that acknowledges uncertainty. So it's tentative speculation, and it's speculation that pays equal attention to what's likeliest, to the likeliest scenario, but also to the worst case scenario. What do you think is going to happen? What are you worried might happen? And those are the two linchpins of the intellectual content, of the substantive content in crisis communication. Another thing you do in crisis communication is give people things to do. You're trying to help people bear their outrage. People can bear fear much more effectively, much better, if they are doing things. So it is extremely useful in a crisis to ask for help, to offer things that people can do to protect themselves, to help others. If you can get them doing things, they will be better able to bear their outrage. Even better than offering them things to do is offering them choices of things to do, so that you're not only involving their ability to act, you're involving their ability to decide. You know, so, you know, here's a menu of things we'd like you to do. You know, try to pick a few, and, you know, here's some easy things if you're not, you know, if you think this is silly, Here are some in-between things if you're on the same page as we are. Here are some pretty demanding things if you think we're not asking enough of you. If you think we're not taking this seriously enough, then go to this third list so that you're involving people's ability to decide, not just their ability to act. Do anticipatory guidance, telling people what to expect. That's very closely allied with being willing to speculate. These are all things you do in crisis communication. Next slide, please. Obviously, any serious nuclear or radiation-related accident is going to be crisis communication. Not so obviously, but importantly, it's also crisis communication if you're in an accident that might become serious. And it's arguably crisis communication if you're in an accident that they think might become serious. That's somewhere between crisis communication and outrage management. Also, crisis communication is involved in if there are upcoming moments in an ongoing cleanup or any ongoing process that are potentially dangerous and alarming, whether it's to employees or to neighbors or to activists. So, you know, if you're doing something and, you know, and it's not a crisis, but you're about to do something scary, you're getting to a scary part of the process, then crisis communication is at least temporarily called for, which I think is all I have time to say about crisis communication. Next slide, please. Down in the lower left-hand corner, I am not going to put a circle. Low hazard, low outrage. I have not found that to be a profit center in my consulting business. When I was active as a consultant, I'm pretty much retired now. I earned my living in the other three corners. I earned my living doing precaution advocacy and crisis communication and outrage management. But I never could find anything to do when hazard is low and outrage is also low. What would you say to people? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. That's not an important risk communication message. On the other hand, if you're temporarily in the lower left-hand corner, that's a different story. You know, if you're in the lower left-hand corner now, but people are going to get upset when they discover something you haven't told them yet. So it's pre-outrage management. Or the danger is going to get high when something happens that hasn't happened yet. So it's pre-precaution advocacy. Or both of those are going to happen and it's pre-crisis communication. If you're temporarily in the lower left-hand corner, then there's communication to be done in order to sort of pave the way for when you get to where you think you're going. So the implications of this, if you look at the map as I've developed it so far, it's a snapshot. Okay? You figure out how high the hazard is now and how high the outrage is now. And that tells you where you are on the map. But you also figure out how high they're going to be in a few months, because you might want to do some pre-outrage management or pre-precaution advocacy or pre-crisis communication. So you anticipate where you think you're going to be on the map. It's also worth saying that this map is specific to a specific stakeholder. As I pointed out earlier, you might be doing outrage management with your neighbors and precaution advocacy with your employees. And it's specific to a specific communicator. You might be doing outrage management and the activist group is doing precaution advocacy. So all of those are in play, but this map tells you which toolkit you need. You look at where you are on the map, you look at where you're going on the map, and then you pick the toolkit that is appropriate to the situation you're in. In sort of medical terms, you know, you got to do the diagnosis before you do the prescription. And locating yourself on this map is the diagnosis, and then the prescription is to choose the toolkit appropriate to where you are or where you're going. Next slide, please. Right in the middle of the map, we have what I call the sweet spot, and that's why I've got a happy face there. But you could just as well take it quite seriously and call it stakeholder consultation, in which case it's a totally legitimate kind of risk communication. People are interested. They're not terribly upset. Or you'd be, in the high outrage side, they're not apathetic, or you'd be at the low outrage side. They're interested. That's in the middle. And they have a stake. There is some hazard, some substantive reason why they ought to be interested, but it's not urgent. It's not nothing, and it's not huge. So you're right smack in the middle of the map. This is where a lot of data get communicated. Very little data in precaution advocacy because you don't have time. People don't listen long enough to give them much data. Very little data in outrage management because they don't believe you and they don't want to hear the data. Very little data in crisis communication because there are more important things to do. You want to evacuate them, not explain things to them. But lots of data in stakeholder consultation and stakeholder engagement. Lots of data there. So, it's rational, calm dialogue with people who are happy to listen and happy to talk. And they're interested. They're not upset. They're not apathetic. You are interested. You're not defensive. You're not, everything's working beautifully. I never did much of this because you wouldn't bring in an outside consultant to advise you on how to talk with calm people. you can just do that yourself. So I rarely had occasion to do it. And for a long time, I didn't acknowledge it as a legitimate kind of risk communication. But of course, it's totally legitimate. If that's where you are, that's what you ought to be doing. Explaining the data, listening to them, dialoguing, learning from them, having them learn from you. That's all perfectly appropriate. But the most important thing I want to say about the sweet spot is it's tempting to stay there. It's fun. It's easy. It's comfortable. And if you're talking to people who are interested and you're not talking to people who are apathetic and you're not talking to people who are upset, if you're spending your time in the sweet spot when things are going on elsewhere on this map, you're mishandling the situation. So the sweet spot is totally legitimate, but it's easy and it's therefore seductive. And the thing I want to emphasize is don't get stuck there if there's hard work to be done in one of the other corners of the map. Next slide, please. So some of the things where stakeholder consultation is in fact what you're doing. With regard to radiation, debating the pros and cons of nuclear versus fossil fuel power generation, a nice intellectual debate, explaining principles of ionizing radiation to people who are interested, using newspapers to educate people about nuclear facilities and cleanups, meeting with mutually respectful people to plan a path forward. So real things happen here, but again, they're seductive because they're easy. Next and last slide, please. Here's the bottom line. We've covered four risk communication paradigms. Watch out, precaution advocacy, when people are apathetic about a serious risk. Calm down, outrage management, when people are upset about a risk that you think is not serious. We'll get through this together, crisis communication, when people are upset, rightly upset, about a serious risk. And finally, let's sit down and figure this out together, the sweet spot, stakeholder consultation, when people are interested in something that that is interesting, but not urgent. And if I leave you with nothing else, I wanna leave you with this. These four toolkits are completely different. Insofar as you wanna be a good risk communicator, get good at all four, but more importantly, get good at figuring out which one is called for. Get good at figuring out where you are on the hazard versus outrage map and choosing the toolkit that fits the situation you're in. And I think that's all I want to say. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Sandman, for the great lecture. And thank you for logging in for real time from New York for a Q&A session. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hello, I'm back.
Okay, so would you like to greet the audience briefly?
I'm delighted to be here. It's a little after midnight my time, and I'm wide awake, having just spent an hour listening to myself and looking forward to whatever questions people might have or comments people might have on the material I covered.
Okay. I would like to go to the first question. Thank you very much for your wonderfully organized, useful presentation of health at risk equals hazard outrage usage. Have you observed any cultural organizational differences in how well your concept works?
Yeah, it's a good and important question. When I started working, and I first started doing international consulting, I was very much afraid that these concepts would not work internationally, that I developed them in the West, mostly in North America and Europe and Australia, I guess. And when I started working in Asia and Latin America and Africa, I really wondered whether it would be the same. And little by little, I became convinced that the basics really are the same. What isn't the same is which components of outrage are likeliest to be dominant. In some cultures, for example, people will experience a problem as a problem of trust. The government or the company is acting in ways that the stakeholders consider untrustworthy. And what they want is a more trustworthy authority. In another culture, the same issue will be seen as a control issue. And it won't be about trust. It'll be, stop telling us what to do. We want to control our own lives. We want to make our own decisions. So there are differences that matter between one culture and another, but the basics of outrage leads to hazard perception, and managing outrage is how you get people either more or less upset so that they are more or less interested in taking precautions. That seems to me totally universal, and I that was hard for me to learn. I was very reluctant to apply my model of things in other cultures until people kept telling me, no, it works here too.
So the outrage is universal everywhere.
I think so, yes.
Okay, and that it plays the basic role. I forgot to mention that was a question from Professor Aya Goto from Fukushima Medical University. Thank you very much, Professor Goto. Another question is from Dr. Segawa. How does outrage relate to the responsibility of a nation promoting nuclear industries and causing nuclear disasters? Hard question.
Well, I mean, as I think everybody knows, if you think about it, outrage sort of conditions or sets limits on what a government can do. So that when outrage is high enough, nuclear industry can't flourish. People are too upset. Nobody wants to live near a nuclear facility. Nobody wants to let another one be built. And you know, certainly, you know, Japan has encountered that since the Fukushima accident. You know, Germany and much of Europe is moving away from nuclear power, or was moving away from nuclear power. Now, because of outrage about climate, there is a sort of a reconsideration of nuclear power. You know, so you know, outrage determines what you can do. How you do what you try to do determines how much outrage you get, you know, so that, you know, I mean, one of the most general observations I have had about the nuclear industry is it tends to be, and maybe, you know, Tomo, maybe this is not universal. Maybe, you know, you'll tell me this is not true in Japan. But in my experience, at least, it's a very arrogant industry. And very reluctant to learn humility. And we're all reluctant to learn humility, but I watched the nuclear industry be among the last. So the chemical companies began to get it, oil companies began to get it, pharmaceutical companies began to get it, and nuclear power companies were still in, you know, feeling like they were a priesthood. They had knowledge nobody else had. They should be trusted to protect us and take care of us and you know, so the nuclear industries and even nuclear regulators have been, this is a gross overgeneralization, but I'll say it anyway. You know, it seems to me that nuclear industry and nuclear regulators have been less able to grab on to the principles of outrage management than almost any other client I had. You know, so I, you know, which kind of makes it fun to talk to them, because, you know, for as long as, I mean, I'm retired now, but for as long as I was in business, they were a reliable client because they never learned.
It may be true that the radiation itself is fundamentally, there's something fundamental about causing outrage from radiation that the industry itself is prone to take it as the basic, or as it is, I guess.
I think you may be right. I mean, you know, I mean, as soon as you start talking about radiation, all the men in the room cross their legs. you know, so I mean, there is something unique about radiation that you know, but that doesn't explain why the people with the most expertise have had the least empathy. And the least ability to understand how what they were doing was exacerbating the outrage instead of mitigating the outrage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I think that your theory is very applicable in the field of radiation or nuclear power industry, I think, because we tend to be not paying attention so much to the outrage or the people's feeling about it. We talk about science or theory or, you know.
In the West, at least, the word priesthood keeps coming up, the nuclear priesthood. You know, critics will keep using that word to try to capture what, you know, the attitude of nuclear experts toward ordinary people and the failure to be willing to listen, to be willing to understand why they're so upset. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you very much for your comment. I think it really kind of reminds me, or like wakes up to the fact that what radiation has in terms of impact to people's feeling and so in the society. Well, it's unfortunate that, but the time has come to the end of the session. So, well, thank you, Dr. Sandman, for joining us in this symposium. And I hope that we hope that we'll be able to continue good communication with you in the future.
I would like that. My pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Well, that will be the end of the session, and we'll take a 5-minute break And we'll, the next session will start at 2:15 p.m. Thank you very much, everyone.